The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Advertising Corporation and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found in his Washington Times Communities column, Forbidden Siegel Talk.
It's time now for The Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but if the Bible is his message, well, how can one possibly accept that book? I mean, come on, it's filled with contradictions. It has miraculous stories no sensible person could consider. No intelligent person could take them seriously. Well, that's not my opinion, as you must know by now, but if it is your opinion, I want to specifically welcome those of you who disagree with me. Welcome to our sanctuary, a sanctuary for skeptics and doubters. Now, last week, I actually began a talk on the credibility of the Bible, and today we are going to pick up right where we left off. But you're saying you missed part one? Relax, Sam. Everything's going to be fine. It can be found posted right on the front page of my website, bobsiegel.net. That's Bob Siegel, S-I-E-G-E-L. .net. So you can listen to part one. I'm going to review a little of it, but you can hear it the way the good Lord intended it to be heard if you go to my website. Before we jump back into it, I do have a comment from one of our listeners, and this is a listener who I know personally, Jim Sills, great guy, fellow staff writer for San Diego Rostra. Well, I'm not a staff writer, but I'm a contributor. He's a writer for the San Diego Rostra. But some of you out there might know him as the chief of staff at both the San Diego City Council and Board of Supervisors, former with both of them, and a veteran political consultant. So Jim says regarding our program, Bob, while listening to your very fine radio show, I heard you mention your program will be shifting to another time on Sunday. Can you fill all of us in on the schedule change and when it will take effect? And then he says something to the other readers and writers of the San Diego Rostra. And he calls them Rostrafarians. He says, Rostrafarians who have not heard Bob's show are missing out. It is one of a kind and will make you think about subjects you have long forgotten and want to consider again. Signed, Jim Sells. Well, Jim, first of all, thank you very much for your kind words about my program. As for the schedule change, I appreciate you bringing it up because I plan to give this announcement throughout today's program. Actually, the schedule change takes place next week, July 3rd. Now, I know a lot of you are looking forward to July 4th. Something else is going on, birth of our nation, something like that. Yada, yada, yada. I know. Okay, that's fine. 4th of July, that's great. I love the 4th of July. The 3rd of July is the big day. The 3rd of July is the big day this year. 3rd of July, you can hear your old pal Bob. The Bob Siegel Show will from now on be heard from 6 o'clock to 7 o'clock p.m., same channel, KCBQ 1170, same day, Sunday. Like the way I'm just walking you through this? I'm just walking you through this like you're a third grader. No insult intended. People need to walk me through things like I'm a third grader too. Same channel, KCBQ, same day, Sunday. But three hours later from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. So don't tune in at 3 o'clock next week. If you do, you'll be grievously disappointed. Actually, I don't know who they have scheduled to take my place. So if it's some other great KCBQ talk show host, well, that would be fine. You should tune in. I don't know who it's going to be, but actually, you never know what they might play on a weekend. It could be a documentary on how to assemble a flashlight for all we know. But if it's a regular KCBQ host, I'm sure it'll be a good show. So you listen in, whatever it is. Anyway, this is our last 3 o'clock show, but you can catch me at 6 o'clock starting next week. Of course, our Saturday night rebroadcast will remain the same, 11 o'clock p.m. right after Saturday Night Sock Hop, which is an excellent program. All right, last week I was laying out a case for the accuracy of the Bible. Let me review what I did last week. And again, you can go to my website to get the details. Why do we believe that the Bible is accurate? First of all, I drew a distinction between proof and evidence. Evidence is that which points to a high probability that a given claim is true. Proof is something we experience through our senses. Now, what's interesting is Christianity and the Bible, which introduces Christianity, can be defended both ways. There is evidence that the Bible is the Word of God, but evidence and proof are not the same thing. The proof is that you can have a relationship with God. In 1 John, the Apostle John says, this is how we know we belong to Him, by the Spirit He has given us. But the Apostle Paul talked about another way that people could know, and that was that the resurrection of Christ was an historical fact that people could look into at any time. And of course, for Paul, it was history not too long ago. Recent stuff, stuff within just the last few decades. And the apostles were very certain, and even when you go to the second century and the early people, this is when the term apologist relating to Christianity first became popular. I'm known as a Christian apologist. The original second century apologists were people that were even defending Christianity in the face of the Roman emperors. Antoninus Pius was one such emperor, and Justin Martyr told him that if he had any doubts about the resurrection of Christ, well, there was a whole report that Pilate made, not only about Christ's resurrection, but things about his trial, things about the miracles. So anyway, when we talk about the accuracy of the Bible, it's evidence. It's evidence backed up by history, by archaeology. Prophecy is also interesting. But I talked last week about prophecy. I mentioned some passages like Daniel 9, which gave a calendar of when Christ was going to come the first time. There is no calendar of when he's going to come the second time, Harold Camping and others notwithstanding. But the first time there was a calendar, and Jesus rode in that very day. Isaiah 53 is another one. It says that the Messiah meaning anointed or sent from God, will come to Israel, die for Israel's sins, then rise from the dead, then rule as king. It says all that in Isaiah 53. And I talked about the fact that people say, oh, well, yeah, sure. I saw this even on Bill Maher's movie, Religious. I finally watched that thing. You have to watch those things when you're a Christian apologist. Maher's a very entertaining guy. And if I had to critique it artistically, he made a great movie. But he really said some horrible things at the end of the movie. Although, boy, some of the Christians who were talking to him and some of the stuff they were saying to him, I don't blame the guy for not becoming a Christian. I don't know if he was just looking for the nutcases or if the nutcases were the easiest to find. But anyway, one of the things he said about fulfilled prophecy, and I've heard this many times before, is, well, sure, you know, the church just went around and rewrote those things into the Old Testament. Problem is, the Old Testament was preserved for us by the Jews, not by the church. I mean, the church preserved, and I said this last week, the church preserved some Greek versions and some Latin versions, but for many centuries, the Hebrew text was in the hands of the Jews. And the Jews are not going to go back. The Jews who don't believe in Jesus, who haven't accepted Jesus, they're going to go back and rewrite Isaiah 53 to make it sound more like Jesus? I don't think so. And then there were other things, things such as the prediction that there'd be at least three different nations of Israel. It's not just about Jesus. There are all kinds of prophecies fulfilled. So I mentioned prophecy. I also talked about the unity. A lot of times when people refer to the Bible, they refer to it as if it's one book. It's not one book. It's 66 different books written over a period of some 2,000 years by over 40 different authors, and yet these gentlemen were all saying the same things about God, and they were witnesses of God's divine activity or claimed that they heard from God. So we talked about that. Then I got into a little bit of the history, and I talked about how with the Old Testament and the New Testament, what we have today are copies, but I pointed out that in ancient history, everything that we have from that era comes to us as copies. I compared, you'll recall, Aristotle. I said from the earliest time of an Aristotle manuscript, a copy of his writing, to the time when Aristotle really lived and really wrote, we have a time gap of 1,400 years. But with the New Testament, we have virtually complete texts within 300 to 200 years of the original, and some papyrus fragments going within 30 years of the original. So it's pretty overwhelming, the evidence we have. Anyway, all those things were just for review. And again, you can go to my website to hear the rest. Don't make me tell you a third time. You're tired of hearing it. I'm tired of saying it. You can go to my website and hear the rest here, part one of that. Now, I want to say something at this point about miracles, because what happens is, since the Bible talks about miracles, people immediately change the rules. And they ought not to do that. When we're talking about miracles, we're really in the realm of science. Now, I know that sounds bizarre to some of you. Quit clutching your chest. Don't have any accidents if you're driving. What I mean is, a miracle would be a scientific question. Is there a phenomenon that we don't understand? That's a very fair question in the field of science. It can be argued that to some degree that may also be a fair question in the field of philosophy. And there are Christian apologists who stress science. You can learn a lot of wonderful things by people that are into intelligent design. My point is that we need to keep one discipline at a time. I once heard a bishop say his conversion to Christianity was his conversion to education. That was certainly true of me. I was in junior college because I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. I wanted to be a playwright. I wondered what I was doing in college. I wanted to just go out to New York and just starve myself. And, well, eventually I went to San Jose State, got a degree in drama. And then for someone that hated college, I actually went on and got a master's degree in Bible study from Denver Seminary. I didn't think I'd ever find myself at a graduate school. So I went ahead and continued doing quite a bit of college, actually. But what kept me in college, what kept me wanting to learn even when I wasn't in college, I'm kind of a self-motivating learner too. I've probably learned more by things I've studied on my own. When I was in college and seminary, I was just trying to get the grade and write the paper. And sometimes they'd bring up something. I'd go, wow, this is fantastic. This is fascinating. Wish I could really get into this, but I can't. I got a paper that's due. I have a test to study for. Really, it was on my own when I finished seminary and a lot of things even before I went to seminary that I learned a lot of the things I've learned, because like this bishop, I would say my conversion to Christianity was my conversion to education. This was something fantastic. I had this relationship with God, nothing unique about me. You can have the same relationship, a relationship with God offered through his Spirit by those who understand and embrace what Jesus did for them and paying for their selfish nature on the cross and offering his life. And yet to defend Christianity, you're touching into so many other subjects. Gets into science. That's one that I haven't gotten into as much, but there are many fine Christian scientists, not the religion Christian science, but Christians who are also scientists. I've had some of them on my show. I had the fellow who wrote the book, The Physics of Christianity. He teaches over at Tulane. Just some marvelous conversations. For myself, though, I was finding myself studying philosophy and archaeology and history and languages and cultural studies. And I mean, it's amazing how many different kinds of disciplines integrate to defend Christianity. So I would say my conversion to Christianity was my conversion to education. That's not the way most people would say it today. Today, most people would say, oh, you got to throw your brains out the window to be a Christian or be a part of any other religion. I know people are saying that with sincerity, but if you're saying that, my friend, you're sincerely ignorant. And I mean that in a nice way. We're all ignorant about things. If you find that you're sincerely ignorant about a subject, your choice is to either not talk about it because you don't know what you're talking about, or look into it. So if you're talking about Christianity in a negative way or in a critical way, that's fine. You're entitled to your opinion, but I hope you're taking the time to look into it. Okay, so I'm going on and on and on, long road to a short house here. I was going to make the point that discussion of miracles belonged in the realm of philosophy and science and not in history. I'll tell you more what I mean by that. Yes, I will eventually make my point when we return to the Bob Siegel Show.
Hey, this is Lori K. Lewis, a frequent co-host on The Bob Siegel Show, Talk Radio 1170 on KCBQ. If you have questions or comments during this radio broadcast, please call Bob at this toll-free number, 1-888-344-1170. Again, the number is 1-888-344-1170. We'd like to hear what you have to say.
So sometimes I love that bumper music so much I don't even want to restart the program. Those are the Doors. Sometimes I like to take just the instrumental sections of these. Of course, that was a vocal piece, Touch Me Babe. Really belongs on a Christian show, doesn't it? That's why I play the instrumental part of it. But hey, you know, if you love your babe, and there's appropriate ways you can be touched too. I mean, kissing. I better not go there anymore. I can just see the phone board lighting up already. Okay, welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. If you'll indulge me, I plan to reannounce our schedule change that begins next Sunday, and I will be doing this at the top of every segment. The reason is simple. Many people listen to the radio while they're driving, which means often they do not hear an entire radio show. I love talk radio. I love it. I seldom hear a whole program. So to cover the bases, I just figure different people will hear different announcements. So thank you for your patience, those of you who are sitting through the whole thing. Don't you hate it when someone says thank you for your patience? There's nothing I hate more than being on a plane, and we're going to be number 12 in a long series of planes coming out the runway. We thank you for your patience. What they're saying is they know we're not patient. They know they're messing up. It's not our fault. So when someone's thanking you for something you haven't actually offered them, having said that, thank you for your patience while I go through and give these different announcements for the drivers or the people who have this on in the background while they're doing yard work or kicking back at the beach. Next week, July 3rd, the Bob Siegel Show will be heard from 6 to 7 p.m., our new time slot. Same channel, KCBQ 1170, same day Sunday, but 3 hours later from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. That's all you have to hear about that until our next segment starts. Okay, I was talking about miracles. Now, why don't miracles belong in a discussion of history? Because history has a certain set of tests and criteria. Science has similar ones, but they're a little bit different in places. With history, you ask questions like, how many eyewitnesses were there? Were these credible historians? Were these people that had a good reputation? Let me put it this way. If the same amount of historians who said, and not just historians, if the same amount of historians and eyewitnesses who said that Jesus Christ did miracles and rose from the dead, one of the greatest miracles of all, if the same amount of historians and testimonies who said that a man named Jesus merely gave a speech, or a man named Jesus merely started a revolution, nobody would doubt it. Technically, we can. Like I said last week, if you don't have a time machine, you can't really go back and personally prove anything in history, but we accept things from history all the time. Did George Washington cross the Delaware? Did Abraham Lincoln give the Gettysburg Address? Beginning of a debate one time, I said, how many of you have been to Australia? Only like three people raised their hand out of a room of several hundred. I said, okay, I'm only talking to the several hundred of you. Does Australia exist? Now, does that sound like a ludicrous question? Well, of course it sounds like a ludicrous question. Of course Australia exists, but if you wanted to be technical, just technical, most of what we call facts in life, we haven't really proven. What we have are what they'd call a really well substantiated hypothesis. How do you know Australia exists if you weren't there? If you're going to say that you can't prove something unless you were there, if you're going to say, well, I won't believe in the resurrection until I see it, okay, then why do you believe in Australia without seeing it? Well, because others have been to Australia. Oh, but Bob, it's on the map. Yeah, well, what if it's this big, big conspiracy theory? What if the films that have been supposedly taken in Australia were filmed in other parts of the world? Okay, does it sound stupid? Does it sound ludicrous? It does, because the odds that we've been duped by some incredible world conspiracy are so microscopic, it's not even worth discussing. But my point is, that's how we accept history. That's even how we accept geography. That's how we accept any fact when we're talking about something we haven't witnessed for ourselves. If you were on a jury and you're trying to decide whether somebody held up a drugstore, if you were not there, if you didn't see him hold up the drugstore, you will never know for sure. Let me say that again. You will never know for sure if you weren't there. But when you're on the jury, you have to still make what's really an educated guess. They say, that's why they say beyond reasonable doubt. Why do they say make your decision beyond reasonable doubt? Because they know that technically you could doubt anything. You could doubt anything. Anything's possible. Not everything is probable. Is it possible that unicorns exist? Yeah, it's possible. It's not probable. I don't expect I'm ever going to see a unicorn. I don't expect I'm ever going to see a leprechaun. Is it possible? Anything's possible. Not everything is probable. Not everything has evidence. So that's why they say beyond reasonable doubt. If you listen to somebody else who says, I was at the drugstore, I did witness it. Okay, well, now you have an eyewitness, but maybe that person's lying. Maybe they're making it up. Maybe the defense attorney's paying them off. Maybe somebody's being framed. Okay, well, then if that's why they bring in more than one witness. It's like what journalism once was and is supposed to be. If you have more than one source, you print the story. So my point is, can you doubt whether Christ rose from the dead? Can you doubt whether Christ did miracles because it's history? Yeah, you could, but you really should doubt everything else in history if you're going to have that kind of standard. Well, why then do people accept so much of history but reject Christ? Well, there's two reasons. One of them is that the minute we're talking about the miraculous, people immediately assume that that's just not possible. So now at this point, if you're assuming that miracles are not possible, maybe we do need to take a detour from history and go over to the realm of science for a moment. And so now let me talk to those of you who are scientifically minded. If science has taught us one thing over the many, many decades where we've had serious science, it's that what people once thought was impossible becomes possible. If you go back and look at textbooks in the early part of the 20th century, they'll tell you it's impossible to split the atom. But they split the atom. Can you imagine if somebody living, even 100 years ago, let alone 2,000 years ago, if somehow they could see into the future and see you talking on your cell phone or see those little figurines dancing on your cell phone or on your television set or see a rocket ship or an airplane or a computer or an automobile? I mean, wouldn't that look fantastic to them? Wouldn't that look impossible to them? But we understand, with hindsight being 2020, that we've just harnessed different scientific data that earlier generations didn't have, and we shouldn't be arrogant about it. That doesn't mean we're smarter than the people that lived thousands of years ago. Some of them were a lot smarter than us. They had less information to work off of. You may be assuming that the guy who's a rocket scientist who builds a rocket ship is smarter than the guy that invented the wheel. But you know what? The guy that invented the wheel had less information to work off of. That might have been a lot harder. The guy that invented the rocket ship had, you know, over thousands, at least in the thousands of years, of information to work off of. So we just assume then, and of course, you know, we have had more technological change since the 1980s to the turn of the 20th century into the 21st century. Just in that period of time, those several decades, we had more change technologically in this world than from the time of Abraham to present. So can you just imagine what it'll be like 100 years from now, 200 years from now, 1,000 years from now? Human beings will be doing things that would just baffle our imagination, but we don't assume they're going to do it with some kind of magic. If people can do that someday, why couldn't God, who created all scientific law, do it right now? Well, we'll be right back while you think of that. This is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated. License number 480-539. W&S Electric. Welcome back to our program. I've been reminding people throughout the entire hour that next week, July 3rd, the Bob Siegel Show will be heard from 6 o'clock to 7 o'clock p.m., same station, KCBQ 1170, but 3 hours later, from 6 o'clock p.m. to 7 o'clock p.m. So we were talking about miracles. When the Bible says that God does a miracle, they're not saying that God's a magician. They're not saying God performed magic. They're not saying that God threw the rules of science out the window. God established the rules of science. How much knowledge do we as human beings have of the universe? If we want to have some humility about this, but I think even an unhumble person would agree that it's a pretty big universe. There's an awful lot to study here on Earth and out in the universe. And if we're talking about the whole universe, life, existence itself, human beings probably know less than 1% of all the obtainable knowledge of the universe. So how does God work his miracles with the 99.9% of the information that we don't yet have? Therefore, a truly open mind, and Christians are always accused of being closed-minded, a truly open mind would consider the fact that we do things in science today that people once thought were impossible. And by the way, there's miracles that go on all the time in medical science. Somebody gets miraculously healed. It's just that doctors don't write miraculously healed. They write cause of recovery unknown. Okay. Well, you don't have to be a slave to words. Never mind the effect of words. Look at what a word means. If the cause of recovery is unknown, the doctor is saying, I do not have a scientific explanation. I was led to Christ by a guy named Roger Cousins. He listens to the show a lot. Hi, Roger. Hi, Vivian. He lives in Colorado, but thanks to the internet, that's really leveled the playing field for radio. So I'm heard all over the country, not just in San Diego. And I remember I hadn't seen Roger for years, but Roger called me on the phone one day, said his wife, Vivian, they'd found what looked like a tumor in her uterus. Excuse me for being so vivid, Vivian, but I know that the two of you were proudly telling this story. But Roger called me and asked me to pray. I prayed. About a week later, I called him back. Of course, he hadn't just called me, he called everybody he knew. I said, hey, what happened? Never heard back from you. He says, well, they went in and took a second x-ray, and the clot, I guess I said tumor. What it was, I think it was a clot under uterus. Anyway, the doctor said it was gone. Now, for those of you who want the charts and the graphs and the pictures and the evidence, it's right here. We have picture A, picture B. We have a medical doctor. Roger said, well, what caused it to go away? He says, I do not know. He said this doctor was an atheist. An atheist. He said, in my medical opinion, this was a miracle. So now we go back. We leave science. We go back to the realm of history. Within history, if we want to open our mind to the possibility that there may be things in science we don't understand, then the fact that the Bible or other books of history say that Jesus did a miracle or rose from the dead should not cause us to immediately dismiss it. If we immediately dismiss it, we're not looking at it with an open mind. In history, that's not a fair question. In history, we say, okay, it may be a miraculous event, but the only way to look at this objectively is to view it as an event. So I'm going to give it the same criteria. How many eyewitnesses? How credible were they? Now, I know some of my atheist friends are out there. This one's all over atheist websites. Now it's become very, very popular. And that's extraordinary claims need extraordinary evidence. Extraordinary claims need extraordinary evidence. My friend, the moment you say that, you're admitting that you're changing the rules. We must have the exact same standard of evidence for history, whether it's an extraordinary event or not an extraordinary event. There's only one question you can ask if you weren't there. How many eyewitnesses were there? If you're going to say that the eyewitnesses weren't enough, then either we're talking about a time machine or you are admitting to me that it doesn't matter how much evidence we show you, you're not going to look at it. Well, if you're not going to look at the evidence, no matter how much we show you, then who's being closed-minded? And I say this with respect. With respect, I used to be so arrogant. I used to say the dumbest things about God, the Bible, Christianity. Never knew what I was talking about. Never knew what I was talking about. I just loved hearing myself talk. I talked against the Bible. I didn't know I was fulfilling the Bible. There's a proverb in the Bible that says the fool isn't interested in learning, only in expressing his opinion. That was me, okay? That was me. So I'm not pointing fingers at you. I'm pointing fingers at myself, but I know that there's people who are looking at this the way I once did. I had a guy out of UCSB come up to our Christian table one time. He says, you Christians are too closed-minded. I said, well, what do you mean? He says, you say Jesus is the only way to God. Well, if you're going to claim that Jesus is the only way to God, that's a closed mind. I said, well, we close our minds all the time. You probably didn't get up this morning and ask yourself if the world rotates around the sun. You might have asked that question when you were a little kid. That's now an established fact to you. The purpose of an open mind is to examine the data, or data, as some put it. And after that, you make a decision. And once you a fact has been established, you close your mind. The mind isn't supposed to be perpetually open. And then I always like throwing these things back. So I turned it back on him and I said, I have a question for you. You claim that you have an open mind. I got a question for you. Are you open-minded enough to consider the possibility that Jesus is the only way to God? I'm starting to sound like William Shatner here. Are you open to the possibility that Jesus was the Son of God? Something like that. Anyway, I don't do a great Shatner, but then he's not too hard. Probably a trained chimpanzee could do a Shatner impersonation. I was watching Star Trek this afternoon. By the way, that's probably why it's still on my mind. One of the old ones, one of the original ones. And anyway, I will get back to the topic now. I honestly will. I said to him, are you open-minded enough to consider the possibility that Jesus is the only way to God? He says, no, I will not consider that. I said, you can't even consider the possibility that Jesus might be the only way to God. He says, absolutely not. I said, why not? Why won't you even consider that? Why won't you even think about that? Ponder it. He says, because that would mean I have a closed mind. I said, no. That's not the way it works. He says, no, I am too open-minded to consider the possibility that there's one way to God. I said, that's not an open mind. An open mind says maybe there's 30 ways to God. Maybe there's 100 ways to God. Maybe there's 15,000 ways to God. Maybe there's 3.5 ways to God. Maybe there's no way to God. Or maybe, just maybe, there really is one God who one day came to this earth and said, hi, I'm God, and I, God, am the only way to God. Now, what is so incredibly illogical about that? After one of my debates one time at Willamette University in Oregon, a guy came up to me and says, why one God? Why can't it be millions of gods? Why can't we have multiple gods? Well, see, in our politically correct, open-minded society, that sounds like a fair question. And it is a fair question. It's just that there's also a fair answer. And I'll tell you what I told him. I said, there's nothing wrong with the idea of multiple gods as a concept. It's just that that's not the way the universe happens to be. If we happen to live in a universe that had many gods, that would be fine. We happen to live in a universe that has one God. Well, how do you know that? Well, then that brings us back to the evidence. If there really is a God who's been revealing himself to this world, and a loving God would be revealing himself to this world, it would be a cruel, vindictive God who would create human beings as a species and then not let us know why he's created us. So a loving God means God would be revealing himself. And I've done this before on previous radio shows. I've talked about how, and this gets us into the philosophy a little bit, that if a loving God has been revealing himself, if he just started revealing himself in the 21st century and had never spoken to anybody before, then that's being unfair and it's showing partiality toward just the more recent people and being disrespectful to people who lived before. So we assume if God has been revealing himself, if he's revealing himself now, he's always been revealing himself. That means he's been around from the beginning of history. There should be an imprint. Generation after generation, testimony of divine activity. How could history have ignored that? Well, that's just what we have with the Bible. History, generation after generation, talking about divine activity. More when we return to the Bob Siegel Show. Looking to build your own website without a lot of cost and trouble? Hi, I'm Bob Siegel, here to tell you about Web Studio. Web Studio allows people to create their own websites simply and easily without knowing HTML. With Web Studio, you avoid the learning curve of front page and the expense of a web designer. Web Studio has 14 different galleries that contain graphics, sounds, and everything else you need. For more information about Web Studio, go to webstudio.com. Welcome back to our program. The theme of the Bob Siegel Show, Christianity and its relationship to politics and pop culture. Sometimes it's more about pop culture. Sometimes it's more about politics. Today, it's more Christianity proper. I know there's a lot that's been going on in the news world. I kind of took a break from that the last couple of weeks. That doesn't mean I've been silent about it, because I'm not silent about anything. I have a column called Forbidden Table Talk on Washington Times Communities. You can just go to the Washington Times online. You can read all you want. I'm talking about Obama's speech, all kinds of things. I also write for the San Diego Roster, the San Diego Newsroom. So you can always check in on how I'm feeling about the political situation or current events in general. But next week, I will get back to that too. Generally, our show's a little bit of both, because I know some people listen more for the politics and others listen more to hear about God. And I kind of enjoy integrating them, because I think the separation between church and state's a lot of nonsense. And I would defend that by starting with the fact that the words are not found in our Constitution. That's a good place to start. And, okay, dare I say it even again? Next week, July the 3rd, the Bob Siegel Show will be heard from 6 to 7 p.m. That's our new time slot. Still on KCBQ 1170. Still on Sunday, 3 hours later, 6 o'clock, starting next week. Okay, so getting back to where we were, William Shatner impersonations notwithstanding, we established the fact that we should be open to the possibility of a miracle, that a scientific mind would be open to that, that a historical mind is merely going to ask how many testimonies there were. And like I said, if the same people who said Christ did miracles and rose from the dead claim that Jesus merely started a revolution or gave a speech, nobody would doubt that, but they could. You can doubt anything that happened 2,000 years ago. Now, there is history outside of the New Testament, which I'm going to get to, but I don't want you to immediately dismiss the New Testament, because as I said, with the entire Bible, Old and New Testaments, we have a variety of writings. Some of it was written as poetry and parable and is not to be taken literally, but then there are times when it's a clear historical account. With the Gospels, we have some accounts. There were four different Gospels. Some of them were from eyewitnesses. One of them, Luke, was not an eyewitness. Luke was an actual historian. And if you don't believe he was an historian, let me tell you about somebody else who didn't believe he was an historian. His name was Sir William Ramsay, a British archaeologist, one of the most noted archaeologists of his time around the turn of the 20th century. He went to some higher criticism schools in Germany, learned that the Bible was a lot of nonsense, and set out to prove it once and for all, went out on some digs in the Grecian-Roman world to show that Luke was a fraud. What he discovered was that Luke was not only accurate, but often more accurate than other ancient historians whom we accept. Now, today, if you go into some of our universities and you get into somebody from the archaeology department, if they've heard of Ramsay, they'll say, yeah, Ramsay doesn't count. The guy's a Christian apologist. He's like Bob Siegel. Okay, yeah. He became a Christian apologist. He started as an archaeologist and became a Christian apologist because of what he discovered. Now, that's not too hard to understand, is it? Now, what I also hear from people is, why accept something on blind faith? This is one of the things that Bill Maher was doing in his movie, Religialist. Don't you get tired of accepting things by faith? Let me say this as carefully as I can. The way the word faith was used in the New Testament and the way it's used today are different things. I'm not going by Webster's Dictionary's definition of faith. Faith, the Greek word, believe, faith, pistis, pisteo, different forms of it, that meant, well, it meant many things. It included intellectual belief, but it meant to trust, to cling to rely upon, to adhere to, which means to obey. People were not saved by going, golly, I have no idea whether God exists at all, but yeah, I know, I'll just pretend he does exist. And when I die, if it turns out that by chance I happen to be right and there is a God, well, then God will reward me for having been so gullible and stupid. Now, that's not the kind of faith we're talking about. And Christians, you need to be careful of that. If somebody asks you to give evidence for Christianity, if you don't have it, don't be embarrassed by that, but offer to look for it or introduce them to somebody that has it or refer them to a book. But don't sit there and go, well, yes, this is such an important teaching. In fact, you're going to be separated from God for all of eternity if you don't accept Jesus. And then they go, well, boy, I don't want to be separated from God for all of eternity. But on the other hand, I sure don't want to give my life to something if I don't know that it's true. So help me out. Throw me a breadcrumb. Throw me a morsel. Throw me a table scrap. Do something. And they go, oh, well, you got to accept it by faith. Faith, after all, is a beautiful thing. That kind of faith is not a beautiful thing. Let's look at the beginning of Luke and see if this sounds like some Sunday school teacher telling people to accept things by blind faith, or see if instead it sounds like a historian. Now, Luke was sponsored by a Roman dignitary named Theophilus. It was very common in those days for patrons to sponsor an investigative journalist. They didn't have newspapers as we understood them, but they'd go out and they would investigate things that they'd heard about. And Luke was sent by Theophilus to the land that we now call Israel. And frankly, they called Israel and Judea in those days too. It wasn't yet renamed Palestine. It was called Israel. And here's what Luke started off by saying. I'm reading from Luke chapter 1, the first four verses. He says, "Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. Therefore, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, it seemed good also to me to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught." Okay, now again, this doesn't automatically prove the Bible, but it does have the flavor of a historian, doesn't it? Now, John, one of Jesus' 12 disciples, was not a historian, but he writes as an eyewitness. And now I'm reading from not the Gospel of John, but 1 John. There were several things that John wrote. 1 John 1, 1 through 4. And listen to the way he talks about this. Notice he's talking about proof. He's not talking about faith. He says, "That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked at, and our hands have touched, this we proclaim concerning the word of life. The life appeared. We have seen it and testified to it, and we proclaim to you the eternal life which was with the Father and has appeared to us. We proclaim to you what we have seen and heard, so that you also may have fellowship with us, and our fellowship is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus Christ. We write this to make our joy complete." That does not sound like somebody asking you to believe something by blind faith, does it? With all due respect to my Christian brothers and sisters, I want to come down on the atheist skeptical side for a moment. People say real stupid things in the name of Christianity. Real stupid, and I can't claim that I've never said stupid things too, but I'm trying to track with you. My attempt here is to show respect from where you're at. When you ask for facts, when you ask for evidence, you have every right to ask that. And that's why I call my show a sanctuary for skeptics and doubters, because your doubts are welcome here. Hopefully we can alleviate the doubts, but doubt just shows a good, healthy mind. Now, some would look at this and say, well, Bob, Luke eventually became a Christian. John was one of Jesus' disciples. We can't trust these testimonies because they were biased. They had a bias predisposed for Jesus. They liked Jesus. Can we accept something even though it's a bias? Let me start by admitting, of course they were biased. Of course they liked Jesus. Of course they have a certain viewpoint. Is that necessarily a problem? It's not. And I'll show you why when we return.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out Bob's daily blog on townhall.com. Bob is also a regular contributor for San Diego Rostra and San Diego Newsroom. And don't forget his website, www.bobsiegel.net. Here, you download past radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and get information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net. BobSiegel.net.
Okay, you might think this is the last time, but then again, I might say it quickly before signing off. So what do you think about that? But let me at least say it this time. Next week, July 3rd, The Bob Siegel Show. Boy, even I'm tired of hearing it. But again, you know what I mean? Not everybody hears the whole show. Well, gosh, my show's so amazingly incredible. Who only hears a portion of this show? A lot of you. I know. So that's why I'm announcing it several times. Bob Siegel Show is moving from 6 to 7 next week on KCBQ 1170. Same day, Sunday, 3 hours later, 6 o'clock. Of course, our 11 o'clock rebroadcast on Saturday nights will remain the same. And even though it's going to be the same show, I am going to be working with a different tech person. I'm going to be working with Paul at 6 o'clock. So I would like to thank Todd, who's been with me for, gosh, it's been about a year, has it?
About a year.
Well, Todd, you've been great. Todd does a terrific job. I don't know if he wants to take ownership for a lot of the wacky things I say and do on this show. He's only been responsible for the tech part of it. But he's done a wonderful job, and he's a great guy. And Todd, I want to thank you, and I hope everybody that works for KCBQ is listening right now from me about what a tremendous job that you do.
Well, thanks, Bob. It's been nothing but a pleasure.
Okay, well, thank you, my friend. And let's continue now with our discussion of the Bible and history. And we, again, like I said last week, we won't get through all of this. I will continue this next week at, I won't even tell you the time. You know by now. You know when I'm going to continue it next week. Anyway, we started off with the question, was the fact that the disciples had a bias predisposed toward Jesus a problem? Everybody has biases. Everybody has biases, but historians still pay attention to them. Winston Churchill, of course, was the Prime Minister of England, Great Britain, during World War II. Does anybody think Winston Churchill had an unbiased view about who was right, Germany or England? Now, Winston Churchill wrote, before he died, a multi-volume set called The Second World War. Do you think Winston Churchill had an unbiased view of World War II? I don't think so. But let me ask you another question, because it depends on how the question is phrased. What historian, what World War II buff, what World War II historian in his right mind would be uninterested in a book about World War II written by Winston Churchill, the Prime Minister of England? You see, it just depends on how we look at this. I always say, well, listen, it's got to be someone who wasn't a Christian. It's got to be someone who hated Christianity, or at least wasn't close to Jesus. I always hear this. Just, if Jesus really lived, if he really did miracles, then there should be a record of it. I want to see a record. But the guys that knew him the best, the guys that followed him around for 3 years, ate with him, breathed with him, slept with him, talked with him, were always in his teaching, they don't count. That's ridiculous. Would you hold any other event in history up to that kind of scrutiny? Which leads to the second reason why people dismiss these things. It's not just because of miracles. It's because Jesus told us to change our lives. I was with a bunch of frat guys. I used to go into fraternities a lot. And as a scheduled speaker, it was to their credit that they even let me come in, and I'd spar with these guys. It was fun. Great guys, fun guys. And I went into the sororities too, but it was a whole different tone with the guys. The women were very gentle in asking questions. The women asked good questions too, but the guys, they were just there to, boy, show me a thing or two and rip me to shreds. And this guy said, we can't trust anything. You know, Jesus never even wrote a book. Never even wrote a book. Everything about him was secondhand. Okay, oh, well, then you have a real problem with Socrates. Socrates may have written something, but if he did, it hasn't survived. Everything we know about Socrates and his teachings we know through people like Plato and Xenophon. So you're going to throw out Socrates? Now, I loved this guy. I loved this guy. He looked me in the eye and said, Socrates didn't tell me to change my life. Socrates didn't say, repent or you're going to spend eternity in hell. I said, thank you for being honest. I appreciate that. Most people would not be so honest. It's to your credit that you're being honest, but make no mistake, that's the problem. You see, as you talk about the biases of historians, my friend, make sure you don't bring in your own bias while you are evaluating this. We've got to give it an objective test. Now, having said that, because this thing gets better, there is this book you could read today. Well, it's a collection of books, things that were once oral, were eventually written down. It's called the Jewish Talmud. And in the Jewish Talmud, a section called Sanhedrin, and I'll even give you the reference, tractate 43a. They mention that there was a man named Jesus who was executed on the charge of sorcery and apostasy. Now, what did they mean by apostasy? Well, Jesus was claiming to be God. for an ancient Jew to claim to be the God of Israel, indeed the God of the universe, well, that was blasphemy. That was apostasy. He deserved to be put to death according to the law of Moses, unless, of course, he happened to be telling the truth. And Jesus did happen to be telling the truth, but they didn't believe that. But we can understand why he would be put to death. Now, of course, the Jews did not actually put him to death. They had to turn him over to the Romans. But the Talmud was written, in many ways, they tried to ignore the Romans in the Talmud. I don't think they ignored them completely, but they considered themselves the religious rulers of Israel, so the Romans were kind of irrelevant. But they acknowledged that somebody named Jesus was executed on the Passover. On the Passover, which is when Jesus was executed, and this is from the time of Jesus, on the charge of apostasy or blasphemy. But what I find intriguing is they also said the charge of sorcery. Now, why did they call him a sorcerer? Because in those days, if you did not like somebody, if you did not want to follow somebody, if you did not believe in somebody, but you couldn't deny the fact that he did miracles, you said, oh, he did it by the power of the devil. Now, most Jews today don't believe in the devil. An Orthodox Jew will grudgingly admit that they believe there is a Satan, but even they don't like to talk about it too much. But in Jesus' day, oh, you could look at the ancient Jewish writings. They believed in Satan. And Satan is an Old Testament figure, too, or what the Jews would call the Holy Scriptures. And they talked about Satan. And in those days, what they considered a false prophet was somebody who did miracles, but not by the power of God. Now, this is a very derogatory view of Jesus, my friends. These are people that had a bias predisposed against Jesus. But historically, that's great news, because you see what I mean now about putting the different pieces of different kinds of testimonies. You look for a multiplicity of testimonies. You don't dismiss the guys that like Jesus, but yes, to be objective, you want to look at the guys that didn't like Jesus. And you know what's interesting? They're all saying the same thing. They're all saying the same thing. From the point of view of a historian, we have this incredible document written by people with a bias predisposed against Jesus, which nevertheless says Jesus Christ lived, was executed on the Passover, and did miracles. Gets even better. Josephus, a Jewish historian born shortly after Christ. Now some say, oh, that doesn't count. How come the historians in Jesus' day didn't talk about Jesus? Because, Jack, they don't call it history until afterwards. That's what history means. Once it makes news, I said this a little bit last week, once in the course of time it begins to affect things, they look back. But boy, Josephus lived close. Josephus was a contemporary of John, the Apostle Paul. Those dudes lived till late in the first century, especially John. Paul was executed in 64 AD under Emperor Nero. John lived well into 90 AD when he wrote the book of Revelation. So Jesus was a contemporary of the apostles at the very least, and who knows how many others who knew him. We know for a fact that Josephus was not a Christian. However, Josephus says this about Jesus, and it's people try to dispute it, but it's there. You might want to dispute it. You might want to say, well, Josephus couldn't have written this. Well, then the burden of proof is on you, my friend, because it's there in every extant manuscript of Josephus, where it should be, what they call the Antiquities of the Jews. And he says here, Antiquities, book 18, chapter 3. He takes a very casual interest in Jesus, writes only one paragraph. Well, this is one of two paragraphs he writes about him. This is the most interesting one. What he's really giving us is not the history of Jesus, but a comprehensive history on the reign of Pontius Pilate. Now, he spends more time with Pilate, which we would expect. We would expect that a Christian would have spent more time on Jesus. But here's what he says. Now, there was about this time Jesus, a wise man, if it be lawful to call him a man, for he was a doer of wonderful works, a teacher of such men as received the truth with pleasure. He drove to him both many of the Jews and many of the Gentiles. He was the Christ. And when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men amongst us, had condemned him to the cross, those that loved him at the first did not forsake him, for he appeared to them alive again at the third day, as the divine prophets had foretold these and 10,000 other wonderful things concerning him, and the tribe of Christians so named from him are not extinct to this day. Now, why would he call Jesus the Christ if he wasn't a Christian? That's one of the objections people raise, because it was a title. I own a copy of the Complete Works of Josephus. There's like 14 different Jesuses in there. It was a common name. Jesus, who was called Christ. There's other reasons why people dispute this. It's not really disputable, but I'll tell you how they dispute it and how I would answer the disputes next week. You are always welcome. And okay, one more time. Next week, see you at 6 o'clock on The Bob Siegel Show.
Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.